todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. Today, we're diving into one of rock music's most fascinating origin stories through the lens of an equally compelling documentary. Our guest is director Jordan Albertson, whose film Boom chronicles the legendary band The Sonics, a group from Tacoma, Washington that laid the groundwork for punk rock before punk even existed. But this isn't just a story about a band, it's about a filmmaker's 15-year journey to capture their legacy. A journey that includes everything from chance encounters with rock stars to guerrilla-style filmmaking. Jordan's determination to tell this story mirrors the raw DIY spirit of the Sonics themselves, and I'm excited to hear about how it all came together. So let's get Jordan on the line. Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast.
Hey, hey.
Well, first of all, Jordan, I want you to kind of outline who the Sonics were and are, why they're so legendary for those who may not have heard of them yet.
Sure. Yeah. So the Sonics were a pretty regional band from Tacoma, Washington from the early 60s. And, you know, they came up from there was a pretty rich, musical sort of area around there. Obviously, you know about the Ventures being one of the best, but then the Wailers, and there were a handful of bands that were, you know, very, very talented and skilled musicians that the guys in the Sonics, they kind of came up idolizing a lot of these bands and a lot of these players. And what made the Sonics different is, according to the Sonics themselves, is that they couldn't really play as well as any of those players. Larry pretty famously, we were talking about guitar tone and how he made his guitar sound the way that it sounded, and Larry was always like, well, I just didn't know how to play the damn thing, and I couldn't play as well as any of the guys in these other bands, so I just played it louder. And I think that sentiment is kind of throughout the entire band. You know, Jerry Rosalie, the singer, was a screamer. You know, he took more inspiration from, you know, your Little Richard and your Chuck Berry, but he always felt that he didn't have the vocal range that those guys did, so he would just scream as loud as he could, so everybody, you know. And Bob Bennett wanted to shake your shirt with his bass drum when he played it. So that, I think, sort of define the sound of that band, and that is how they became known as this almost like a proto punk band before anyone had, you know, used the term punk rock. These guys were sort of emulating that just in their attitude towards their instruments and how they played. So that, you know, historically, that was I think what separated them from a lot of those other bands, you know, is in their minds, you know, lack of musicianship, I think, led to a attitude and a force in those records that made them really unique for their time.
What was it about them that made you want to document this amazing phenomenon?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, one mainly my dad introduced me to them when I was really young, and so they became this band that my father and I bonded over. And at the time, you know, I never really heard anyone else talk about them. So they were sort of this little, as far as I knew, like this little secret between my father and I, because when he talked about them, you know, they were a band that he would see in bowling alleys and at, you know, a place called Pearls. You know, he lived out in Bremerton, Washington, and so he would see the Sonics as this sort of little regional band. And when he introduced them to me, that was how he described them. And then when I heard the records, it was like, you know, me as like a young kid listening to Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam and you know, Mudhoney and all of those bands, plus getting into punk rock music, it was like my dad knew of this punk rock band before punk had ever been defined. So I had always really loved the band, and when they reunited and kind of came back in 2008 when they played that show at the Paramount Theater in Seattle, I just got this idea to try and make a film about them, and that was when I started working on it.
Well, I understand that you saw that show with your father. So, could you talk about that father-son connection to the band's music and how that specifically influenced your determination to tell their story, even with all the ups and downs that you had throughout production?
If you watch the film, the story about my father and I is in the film, and that was never intended. That was actually like way throughout the process of making the movie. You know, when you're making a doc like this, you especially when you just sort of hit the ground running. I mean, you at least I imagined at some point, you know, Dave Grohl seems to narrate all these things. Like, you know, you'd end up with a Grohl or a Henry Rollins or somebody to step in and
Exactly. Yeah.
yeah, and do that. But I once I decided that I was going to be the narrator and kind of weave the story of my dad and I and how we bonded over this band, you know, and then the movie became kind of meta in this weird way. But yeah, I mean, as far as try to bring it back around to the question, is it as far as you know our relationship and how it sort of, the truth is my dad and I really were not close until this bond over this band happened, and it, you know, it carried throughout the majority of my life, so it really did mean a lot to me. You know, that really was one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story. It became so personal to me, and I just loved the band so much. So it was really like those were the two things that made me want to jump into this.
There's this incredible moment that you've spoken about before, but maybe those listening haven't heard the story about how you kind of randomly met Mike McCready of Pearl Jam while working at a restaurant in Montana, of all places, which you said kind of saved the movie. Can you walk us through what that was like going from a chance encounter to suddenly having access to all these legendary musicians for your documentary?
Well, sure. So I had spent about 7 years trying to make the movie. Like once I reached out to Buck Ormsby, who was the band's manager, and he owned all the licensing for the music. So Buck had to become a partner. And then once, you know, we decided to make this movie and I moved forward with it, I assumed I'd be able to go back to LA and just get $1 million and make the movie. And as you very well know, that's not how these things go. So it took me quite a few years to figure that out. And, you know, at the time I was working on a bunch of other narrative movies, and everything around me started to fall apart. And so as a last ditch effort, I did a Indiegogo campaign to raise the financing for the movie, and that ended up bombing catastrophically. I think it pulled
Ours did too. Yeah, it was. It's crowdfunding isn't as easy as some people make it seem.
No, it's difficult. And we definitely fell on our face with that. We made around $11,000, and half of which I think came from my father. And so it was just really humiliating. And with everything else just falling apart, it seemed like the movie, there was just no chance to get it made. And then also right around that time, Buck Ormsby passed away. And Buck was he was my connection to the band, my connection to any other rock stars. And so that was truly like the death of the movie. Like there was no movie. And so my wife and I moved out to Montana, and I really gave up on movies. I gave up on certainly on the Sonics movie, but just movies in general. And I got a job at a sushi restaurant, and I didn't talk about my past with film. I was just kind of embarrassed by it. I felt like I'd let Buck down, and that was it. I thought this was my life now. Here I am working at a sushi restaurant in the middle of Montana. Like, this is it. And one day, Mike McCready walked in the restaurant, and I just sort of assaulted him with this pitch. I was like, I've been trying to get in touch with you for 10 years. I'm making a movie about the Sonics. And he was really like my number one sort of celebrity that I knew that I wanted for the film, because I knew, one, he's from Seattle. Two, I knew he was like a huge fan of the band. And for him to just all of a sudden walk into this restaurant, it was crazy. And yeah, so I like pitched him the movie, and he right there on the spot just said, "Oh, that sounds cool. Like I'm in." And I remember walking him and his family to their to the table that I set for them at this restaurant, and thinking to myself, I don't have a movie. Like, what the hell am I even talking about? There's no, like, the movie's dead. I just told him I'm making this movie, and he agreed to do it. And I just instantly started sweating and having like a panic attack. I'm like, now what the hell do I do? And he kept pulling me over to his table, and he was like, "Well, tell me more about the movie. I wanted, so what are we doing?" And I'm like, "Fuck, okay." And I just kept chatting about it. And then at one point, he pulls out his cell phone, and he's like, "Okay, well, who else do you need?" And he texted all these rock stars, and like basically validated like my whole journey up to that point. And it gave me the fire I needed, because at that point I was so depressed. And so I called up my cinematographer, Chris Kozer, and I was like, "Hey man, we're back. We're making the movie." And he's like, "Oh my God, you got financing?" And I was like, No, we don't have any money. But Mike McCready said he'll be in the movie, and I got Nancy Wilson texting me all of a sudden out of nowhere. And so yeah, what do you think? And he was just like, "Well, I guess we're gonna have to steal some equipment." And that was basically how the film came together. We would sort of borrow whatever equipment. If he was shooting a commercial, I'd come out to Seattle, and we'd knock out a couple interviews, steal whatever equipment he had at the time. And I wasn't gonna edit the film, because I'm not an editor. I figured we'd hire one, but I became like the editor, and then, like I said, eventually became the narrator. And yeah, I mean, that's just how the whole thing ended up coming together.
I love that story. It's like the universe was saying, Jordan, you have to make this movie. And you did, which is such a great accomplishment. And it's such a great film. But I want to kind of circle back to how you have embraced the Sonic sort of DIY philosophy, because the Sonics recorded their iconic sound on a two-track recorder in an advertising studio. And similarly, you had to get creative with your filmmaking approach, even, like you said, stealing equipments from other shoots. But how did that DIY spirit mirror the band's own story?
Well, it's definitely not lost on me that like the band's kind of rough and tough kind of DIY nature spoke to the kind of shaggy dog nature of the making of the movie, you know? And it wasn't what I intended to do, but it ended up just sort of being whatever it was. And I think it gave me the I don't know if freedom is the right word, but it sort of allowed me to know that I'm not, you know, married to perfection or you know, everything having to be totally refined in terms of like the storytelling. Like I knew that I was able to kind of go like, okay, like, well, fuck it. Like the gloves are off. I can just grab this thing by the horns and just kind of wrestle this thing to the ground in the editing room. You know, dirt and all, you know, and knowing that it was a movie about the Sonics, I think gave me that latitude, if that makes sense. Like if this was a movie about, you know, Yes or something like that, I don't think it would have really worked that way, but I also probably would have never made a movie about the band Yes. But yeah, that's a really good question, but that DIY kind of punk rock, do it yourself, you know, by whatever, that became kind of my North Star, I guess, in how to do it. And also, you know, once I learned Buck Ormsby's story and how he would sort of just do it by whatever means. You know, I feel like I kind of took his spirit as best as I could to keep the fire burning under me to get this thing across the finish line.
Yeah, and it's hard to keep a fire burning for that long.
Yeah.
It's definitely kind of a up and down process, and your film did take 15 years to complete, which is actually not unusual for a music documentary. But during that time, you experienced some profound personal changes, losing your father, your brother, becoming a father yourself. How did those life events shape the final version of the film compared to what you originally envisioned?
Wow. Well, the original vision, like when I was 24, and the movie that I pitched to Buck was going to be this very like David Fincher-esque movie where I was going to interview the band members and anyone else who was around at that time, and then do all these like historical recreations at a real high, you know, sort of production value. And I completely threw that away. So like the movie itself is like that movie literally like died. And then I managed to get this interview with Buck before he passed away, just because I knew he was sick. And once I heard Buck's story and then what he had done, that became this whole kind of how Buck had kept the band alive throughout the 70s and 80s. That made me realize, like, okay, I can't make this movie, but there is a movie about the Sonics that I can make. And I think if I just follow that, you know, like almost like a journalist, just kind of follow this storyline and wherever it may take me. So, you know, the filmmaker in me, the writer director in me, the perfectionist, I had to just like literally shut that person up and put him away and just kind of go like, okay, I'm just gonna follow this thread. And, you know, another part of the question is, you know, when I first started to make this movie, I was really young and full of like spit and vinegar and my like ultimate sort of mission statement was to prove that the Sonics were the first punk band. And there became, like, as I got older and as I had children, and as my family members passed away, and I really got to know these guys in the band, it became clear to me that, like, that question, that doesn't matter. Like, whoever was the first punk rock, I don't know, I'll let somebody else figure that shit out. It was like the story of what these people did, and this extraordinary thing that they got to do later on in their lives became so much more interesting to me, just as a human being, trying to, like, plant the flag and whatever, who was first and who was this and who belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all that stuff. I like I cared a lot less about that, and it became way more human to me. And obviously, with my story and my father getting kind of woven into it, that was all way more interesting and more to me what the film became about.
Yeah, it really is a great humanistic story as well as a music story. And it's great that you were able to use so much of their actual music, which isn't always the case with the high cost of music for film. How you interviewed all five members of the Sonics, which is not always possible with a band that has been around that long. Members do happen to kind of die off at times, but you managed to talk to all of them over that 15-year period. What surprised you most about their perspectives on their own influence, given that they were a relatively short-lived band, but went on to shape other music for generations?
That's a really good question. The one thing that I think was universal with all of them is that they couldn't fully understand it. Even just me trying to make a movie about them, it was so weird to them, so strange. And it took me a while to realize, but I had to put it into some sort of perspective for myself. Like, if I did something when I was 18, 19, 20, 21, and then, went on with my life doing something completely different and really didn't look back on those days, because these guys never got famous. They were, like, locally kind of famous. I'm sure they were the kings at parties or whatever, but they weren't, like, famous, And then to find out 40 some years later that, that this thing that they did when they were these kids, changed people's lives. Or in my, for me, it was like, not only did I love the music, but it was the thing that shaped my relationship with my father. I think, all five of them had a hard time grasping that as an idea. I mean, that's pretty profound if somebody lays that on you, It's not like if you're in the Beatles for 10 years, like, everybody who was in the Beatles, like, they knew they changed the world. Like, they lived that, But the guys in the Sonics, I mean, they became, they joined the military, and they Jerry Rosalie poured concrete for his life, most of his life, Andy was a woodshop teacher. They didn't experience fame. And even though they did get to reunite and travel and finally get a little bit of that glory, I don't think that they ever fully were able to come around to kind of grasping what that is, And now, I don't know if you heard, but Bob passed away a week ago. And the last time I saw Bob was in September at the premiere of the movie, and he was still, like, he pulled me aside at one point. He's like, "God, Jordan, people are asking for my autograph." And I was like, "Bob, you're amazing. I mean, there's all these people here. I just spent 16 years of my life making a movie about you. Like, you." And he just was like, "Oh, wow, thanks." I'm like, "God damn it. Like, when is this going to sink in, So yeah, I think that was the big takeaway, is that all of them really had a hard time grasping that idea.
Yeah, well, they finally got to live the rock and roll dream, which brings me to my final question for you. And this is a question that I ask everybody on the podcast. What is your own personal rock and roll nightmare?
Wow. Honestly, being on stage playing in a band is not something I want. That would be a nightmare to me. My dream is always to be in the crowd because I am a fan and I'm a fan of music, and that's where I belong and that's where I want to be. So yeah, my nightmare would absolutely be to be up on stage playing.
Yeah, so many things can go wrong up there with the spotlight, but
Oh.
yeah. And just having a bunch of people looking at you, watching your every move. Oh my gosh, yeah, same here.
Not for me.
That's why we're making movies about rock stars. So, where can people watch Boom?
So Boom is now available to rent or buy on iTunes and Amazon, and it's going to be coming out internationally soon. But right now, yeah, it's available on digital and VOD, which
That
is
is so
crazy.
exciting.
Yeah,
I'm
it's
so
crazy.
happy for you. Yeah, I got to see the movie on the big screen in Gig Harbor, Washington, a few years back, and it was really fantastic to see the crowd reaction. But now people can watch it at home and really absorb everything, which I think is fantastic. And I encourage everyone to watch it and post about it.
Thank you so much, Stacey.
Thanks.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening. Well, she's by